I was thinking during the previous presentation how interesting it is to see we are using the same labels, the same wording, foundations. We are using foundation, something that is not used in the Anglo-Saxon world, as far as I know. So there must be something common, shared, even in the last 10 or 20 years of changes. I'm more, in a sense, a micro-economist than a macro-economist, so I'm not giving you figures about similar trends in Italy, though that would be, of course, of interest. Just to give an idea of numbers, these are not very updated numbers, but just to give you an idea, we have almost 3,500 museums in Italy, and 500 of those are national museums run by the ministry directly, and 1,500 are local authority museums. That's a long old tradition, it's the 19th century, I mean, Napoleon conquer and just taking out everything from the church and give it to private, to public entities. So, I mean, it's a very different story, perhaps. The numbers are, of course, talking about Italy as a whole. I would suggest in Italy particularly to be very careful about numbers, because numbers reflect very marginally the importance of collections. I mean, a national museum are the most important, with the church museums themselves, and local authorities in museums. So despite they are just a bit more than half, that is the most important part of collections, so at least in Italy. And what I was also thinking when during the previous presentation is how we tend to use a very generalized, very common, very shared language, apparently. I'm not sure that we mean the same thing. You know, I could be the idiot proof, you know, because I don't know the law here. I don't really understand exactly the various categories that you are using, and that just evoking something to me, just rhetorically suggesting something which is not necessarily true. Foundation, are we sure that what you mean by foundation is exactly what we mean by foundation? And according to my experience, the answer is no. The default is no. You have to really check one by one the meanings that are involved. And doing my research in China and elsewhere, that is the interesting element. I mean, we are using the same language. It's some kind of things that appear to go in the same direction, what in organizational theory is called isomorphism. Going all organization changing toward the same, as a very similar kind of form or format. But that is just language. This is just appearance. Then when you go inside individual organizations, that's not true. Not necessarily true. I'm talking today I'm talking about Pompeii and tomorrow about local authority museums. I'll give you examples from Italy in depth. And Pompeii is really the experiment of autonomous entity in Italy. So it's a rhetoric of autonomy. And I'm working on a different level, really trying to see how is the notion of autonomy really construct. I could present a new version of the paper. We are writing a paper with one of my PhD students, Pompeii 10 years after, which is quoting the rock and roll group 10 years after. And it's crazy. I mean, it's not the collapse of walls that happened last week. It's the collapse of an institution. But if you want, I can provide a draft of the new paper. But I prefer to go through the 10 years old paper to explain you the changes that are involved at the national levels. So in a sense, the managerialism in Pompeii was really addressing the whole agenda. At that time it was Beltroni, was the vice prime minister of the first Prodi government in 1996-97. And they're starting this kind of reform for Pompeii. There have been years and decades of debate, and that was something for the first time something was really happening. And in a sense, I'm talking about Pompeii, which is the most important archaeological site in Italy, and not only in Italy, perhaps. It's not just an example, it's much more than an example. Pompeii was chosen explicitly, deliberately, by Beltrone to make some sort of institutional experiment. So transforming it from a soprintendenza, which is the, I don't know if it's the term, I think it's familiar for you because it's something that has, in the Spanish kingdom, that was the soprintendenza as well. So, which is the local branch of the Ministry of Culture, transforming it into a new status of soprintendenza autonoma. There was supposed to be an experiment, on an experimental base, and the word managerialism and management was really inside that the press, the debate, the ministry itself was always referring to. One of the new changes is the establishment of a city manager. The press and the ministry were talking about the city manager is not the word in English. City manager, also in the Italian press and the mouth of the ministry, is not in the law. I think that you cannot use foreign laws in languages. And in the language is simply direttore amministrativo, which is administrative director, financial director, something like that. But it was referred to as a strong, empowered director that deserved the term manager. So it's interesting. And this is the part of the administrative change that was coupled with another more professional trend in changes that was summed up in the plan for Pompeii, the Piano per Pompeii, that was issued in 2006, if I'm right, or 7, by the Superintendenza itself and the World Monument Fund. It was a plan for Pompeii which was raising the point, we need to recover Pompeii, we need to make a systematic plan for recovering, mapping all the monuments, houses that were in need for restoration, calling for 500 billion lira at that time for the following 10 years. So there was a strong project which is from a professional base. It's not just managerialism from the outside. There is a strong project, the idea, tension of change by professionals, and in a sense the institutional transformation was supposed to help to support this major change. So, in a sense, that was my youth, or at least 10 years younger, or 12 years younger, and I still remember the talk I had with the superintendent. It was really nice. I was quite at the beginning of my research. It was the second or third year I was doing this kind of research, and I was spending 4 long afternoons talking with him for hours about his job or what it means to be a director of an excavation site, just trying what do managers do in terms of more elements. And we were talking about this kind of Pompeii reform as a sort of social laboratory, social experiment. Don't ask me now what is the result of this experiment 10 years later. But as a management scholar, you know, it's funny. When I was starting I had to go to Pompeii. I had to study at Pompeii. I love this kind of research because being a micro organizational management scholar, you cannot do desk research. You have to go to Pompeii, stay 3 weeks in Pompeii. So that's what I like in my research. And people say, come on, that's already changed. There's the new law. Come on, law is a marginal aspect. It can have an impact. Policies can have impacts, but how practices changes is what I'm interested in. So to understand what is the situation, I need to, I need to understand what is the problem in Pompeii from an organizational point of view. What are the antecedents? What are the past and present functioning? What are problems, the nature and magnitude of changes that are needed? And then we could see whether the law is capable to cope with this kind of need for change. So basically, I was studying, that was the law was approved in September, I guess, 1997. And I was doing this study between October and March. March, the city manager took its position, and I remember exactly the timing because I was going to the UK to write the paper after my research. So I was April and May. I was already in the UK. So I was not writing a paper on what happened with the reform. It was a sort of paper wrote by an historian. I mean, this is the history of Pompeii. These are the problems. And to what extent the new law are capable to intercept this kind of problems, and they are able on the paper, even before people can do mistakes, can misapply the law. So in a sense, it's a historical paper. So I'm trying to understand the kind of activities that are done in Pompeii, the organizational aspect, people, basically, and money. Then, I mean, this is the first time I'm presenting this paper after the destruction of the Casa dei Gladiatori a week ago. And it's so sad being here talking 10, 12 years later, 13 years later, about the same talk about preservation without really seeing anything seriously. The idea of recovering Pompeii was a very clear, very strong perception by professionals. And I was trying to see, understanding the ruin of Pompeii as an organizational issue, what the organizational causes of the ruin of Pompeii, and how the law will be able to change such a situation. The more I speak, the more I'm getting sad. I didn't expect that. So, if you look at Pompeii from as a management scholar, as an organizational scholar, there are two aspects that are particularly interesting. One is the multi-activity that is taking place there. Running a site like Pompeii is such a complicated, articulated kind of job. It's not one job, it's many jobs. First is wording. You know, you have to take care not just of the, according to the Italian law as a superintendenza, not just of the site itself, but of the, basically the county, more than the municipality, something in between the municipality and the county of Pompeii. It's really a sort of responsibility of police, of the art, of the archaeology in the area. You have to overlook, you have to care that no one is stealing things above or below the ground, anywhere in this area. So that's a huge activity. Then there's a huge activity of wording in the city, in the cities, because it's Pompeii. The what we define as a site, Pompeii as an administration, to be sure there are five or six locations. Pompeii, Bosco Reale, Ercolano, Oplontis. So there are, some of them are very small places, but Pompeii as such is just a sort of an abstraction. And you have to do research. When the BBC made, BBC Horizon is one of my favorite channel, made a very beautiful service on Pompeii and the risk of an eruption of a volcano, was going to Pompeii to talk with the archaeologists of Pompeii that are the specialists in material knowledge. I mean, in the university you have archaeologists, you have any kind of specialist, but the people that know Pompeii and the relationship between objects and the site is there. BBC was not going to the university. So there's research, though the question to what extent sites and museums should do research is another of the controversies in the last 10, 20 years. This issue of restoration and maintenance, there was a very clear cut decision by the superintendenza, very courage. I mean, say, let's stop excavation. which is in a sense a sort of suicide in terms of, you know, for the passion of archaeologists. Asking two archaeologists not to dig is like asking a musician not to play. I mean, it's a, but that was a very, very clever, I mean, we don't have money. I mean, 2/3 of Pompeii is already excavated. 1/3 is still buried. We don't have money. We don't have money to protect what we already excavated. So stop excavation. And that was a very, and we have to say that the vice ministry, Veltroni was keen to accept this. Not his successor, there was the same party, but a lady that was trying to give rise to excavation. For a ministry, having Pompeii doing excavation, it's a free of charge advertising political campaign for hours, weeks, all over the world in TV, that the something that is excavating, and the ministry can be there and say, we discovered that. Yeah. So it was, stopping the excavation was a very radical choice. And basically what you do in Pompeii is a huge work of, you know, very, I would say, marginal, very boring, very normal kind of restoration. There's nothing heroic in Pompeii. There are 1,400 houses, and apart from the 3,000 square meter of mosaics and 20,000 square meter of frescoes, the rest is just simple walls, which is very simple, very. So there are a lot of trivial work, so to speak, that you have to deal with. You just simply have to run it and to organize it. Most of it is outsourced. And when you do outsourcing in a place like Pompeii, the risk to outsource directly to the 'Ndrangheta or to the Camorra is very, very, I mean, that is the social environment, unfortunately. And one of the major issues is to plan the maintenance of what you already repair. I mean, you know, if you see pictures, you know, Pompeii started to be excavating 1740 something, and some of the houses have been there out, not just 2,000 years old, but they have been out for 250, 60, 70 years. And the wind is terrible. The salt is terrible. The sea is just very close. So it's really a question of how long it will take to disappear, to, in a sense, to be destroyed. Of course, we are trying to help them, to help the destruction, as you will see, if you don't do exactly this kind of work. And then there is another completely different kind of activity, which is managing people. And for once, this is, you know, that's one of the few sites that have no problems of tourists, of visitors. On the contrary, there are too many visitors, perhaps. So there are more than 2 million visitors in Pompeii, 200,000 in Ercolano. The quality, though, is still a problem. And it was so funny, I mean, for years I was collecting journals, newspaper, talking about Pompeii, the decay of Pompeii, the houses that are closed, the dogs that are barking, I mean, I don't like dogs, I'm scared by dogs, and that's 200 wild dogs in Pompeii, and nobody can do anything with them, and nobody can get rid of bloody wild dogs. That's an administrative issue. I will come back to this later. And also there are a lot of problems in terms of quality of the visit. You have this hundreds of private guide that guide tours in South Pompeii, say the most rubbish kind of things that you, I mean, it's basically 90% sex. It is sex and Pompeii, basically, the kind of visit that is there. And you have no control on the quality of things that are said. People when come there, and a bloody guide will be unsatisfied by the visit and would not be able to acknowledge that this is responsibility of the superintendent, that this is private operator that has nothing to do with. I mean, you will get unsatisfied, basically, with the visit. And there's a lot of talk about that. And also there is a question from an organization point of view of territorial differentiation. You have several different sites within the site. And so here you have the figures Pompeii, Herculano are the big ones. The other are really small sites with very few visitors, and that are basically students that are forced to go there by the bus, and then no choice. So let's go and see. This is the, it's a very complicated activity. I mean, what do managers do? I mean, I'm not taking terms of time in this case, but it's trying to understand, to describe. You know, there's something so disturbing as an historian doing management research. Most of the time people are telling you, you're doing a kind of descriptive research. People don't like to waste time in understanding. They want a model. So I spend a lot of time in understanding and describing, simply describing what they do. And then I try to relate this to my own special kind of toolkits, if you want. There's a question of structure, the question of numbers of people, and it's a question of operating mechanisms in managing people. One thing is interesting here, it's a huge organizational structure. You have these administrative offices, scientific area, technical area, and this you have the different sites, three different, the most important, Ercolano, Stabia, Pompeii, and other places outside, with two elements. It's very difficult to understand who does what. We spent 2 months to reconstruct the organizational chart that was not there. It's a very fragmented kind of division of labor. Here you have four people working on photocopies, making zero copies. And if there's nothing to do but photocopies, they sit and stop and do nothing but photocopies. Very unionized, very public sector union regulation. This is your job. If you are level three workers for in electricity, you cannot do this or that operation and so on. Very fragmented. And also with this kind of this kind of replica of the models in Pompeii. Pompeii is huge. And Pompeii has laboratory carpenters and so on. And they made the same mistake to do the carpenter in Ercolano and also in Stabia. And the carpenter was not able to work because the workshop was closed in Ercolano. It was not possible to move him in Pompeii because of the unions. And because of the, you know, very rigid kind of system of, you know, privilege, which have been no managed for centuries by anyone. And I think it was one of the most interesting things was a superintendent that told me, look, have a look on the memo of the commission. There is a commission between the organization and unions. I said, come on, who cares about this kind of, look at it. It was fascinating, the discussion on the organizational solution. The administrative director, we are talking before the reform now, and she was asking to the trade unions, give me a suggestion for how to organize our offices. And they say, come on, that's your job. You make a proposal, we will bargain, we will criticize, but it's your job to find an organizational solution. And they were talking about all this kind of unionized aspects. Nobody really cared of cost, impact of this discussion. It is fascinating. If we're talking about human resources, here is 711 people plus what are called in Italy lavoratori socialmente utili, which is some sort of welfare, people, unemployed people that are used. And they take 6 months to have a complete register of who was supposed to be there. So, but these are the numbers of permanent employees, 711, lots of working staff, 423. 124 indirect general kind of skills and profession, amongst which 34 were typewriters in 1997. What do you do with typewriters in 1997? 34. That's a totally a situation where no one is responsible of anything, basically. This is individual patronage, people asking to the ministry for progression. Do we need typewriters? Who cares? But it's not a question. We need this, and this is the people that can do that. People have their own right to become upper level. So 34 typewriters, 1997. There is some consistency. There were just two computers at that time. 1997. Hidden deficit, we were talking today. Okay? Few workers, I mean, just 87. There was just merely day-to-day emergency. You know, just it's a wall collapsing, go there for 2 days, 3 days, and then the other wall collapsing, go there. And if you're slow, the wall really collapse. And that is astonishing. Few technicians, people with some kind of skills and background that has to do with an archaeological site. 77, if you consider archaeologists, architects, historians, that are those that can manage, can direct the work in different sites, there are 17 amongst 711 people. That's a crazy result of, what we call sottogoverno. I don't know if you have a similar expression, which is really local bargaining clientele and these kind of things. And I think that this is a huge responsibility of the ruling class in Naples, in Pompeii. It's a great responsibility of professionals themselves that were unable to address these things. You need a professor, brilliant as he can be, myself, in 1997 to address the issue. Come on, that's your job, that's the way you can survive or not. So, and this is the number this articulated also. It's crazy. I mean, the 16, was archaeologists, architects, and historians, just 16. Isn't it crazy? Isn't it crazy? So, this has been a chapter out of control of anyone for centuries. So, in terms of operating mechanisms, there are a lot of anecdotal examples that I'm providing in the paper. And the working hours, there is a flexible, this is a very interesting example of, problem of centralization. You have the right of flexible time, what we call flexible time. You, as a worker, has the right to decide whether you will go to work between 7 or 8, and whether you have you come in the afternoon 2 days or 4 days, and you have a break. That's your decision. In the end, you have to do the 36 hours as a civil servant, but it's up to you, in a sense. Which is, okay, that worked. Before entering the university, I was working in the private sector and I was using my flexible time as much as possible. Now the problem is if you have some workers, team, and you don't understand that the team is a team and you leave the decision individually, the amount of time that the team is ready to work is residual. So the overlapping of 5 individual plans with this kind of democracy means that people will work 20, the team will work 20, 22 hours a day. Even the left wing goal of 30 hours, it's the right wing, it's Thatcherism in this context. I mean, no one is really work. Even if you want to work, you cannot work, and you go in the working side, and you have to repair the wall. If you start preparing stuff, it's time to go. So please don't do anything. At least we save on material. That's crazy. But this is clearly, when you explain this kind of example of people that are bureaucrats, 100, 200 or 300 miles away. Ah, I never thought about that. So there are hundreds, tons of decision contexts that they never thought. And there was someone that was hired on a temporary basis. At the end of the period, 6 months, the superintendent was not happy with him. He wrote to the ministry and said, "I'm not happy with this. You should not take him." And the ministry say, "Have another go, another 6 months." And the superintendent said, "This is as bad as before." The bureaucrats was managing the procedure slowly, more than the 6 months allowed by law. So the worker went to the unions and say, I have not been fired in the right time, and they had to keep him. So, there are weaknesses. I mean, there is an inefficiency, but that's not the most important thing. There's a lack of knowledge. If you go in a different context, so Pifizio de Pietradura in Florence, that was very active with the Florence Fleet, they were capable to capitalize on knowledge on the whole restructuring they've been doing after the Florence Fleet in 1966. They are one of the most important knowledge center in restoration in the world now. That's not Pompeii. Outsourcing everything for 30, 50 years and you lose any knowledge. And third, inability to spend, because you have this kind of bottleneck of few professionals that can run the work site, archaeologists, architects, and historians. That means that you have the capability of running projects is reduced. And this is really the kind of centralization, lack of managerial knowledge. I mean, when the lady was asking the unions to provide a solution, they don't know what is management all about. They never had a single hour in training in human resources and in cost or budgeting, nor the superintendente, which is something happening all over the world, I would say, or used to be something happening. But even the administrative director, she was a lawyer, as 90% of administrative directors in our ministry. By the way, the ministry is 25,000 people. Financial resources, that's our number, that's our ridiculous number. Why walls collapse? There is an organizational issue. There are a very formal process of request and allocation. You can request anything for urgency, nobody really cares. They give you the money of the last year, more or less. And there are six different items. There are no reporting system. There is no, I'm talking about before the reform of Pompeii. Now Pompeii is a bit different, but all the rest of superintendenza in Italy, with the exception of other four, are still in this situation. There is no systematic report. There is not a normal accounting report at the end of the year. And in terms of substance, money was just few and few and few. It was just 3 billion lira, 1,500 million euros for restoration at that time, which for such a site is really nothing. 3 billion lira, yeah. And in total was 5-6 billion lira. So it's really a primitive mechanism. There are no cost center. There are no, people are not accountable. I mean, the cost of personnel is ignored. I mean, it would take, I guess, no more than one afternoon to go in the database of the ministry and just insert a new record, which is you're working in Pompeii 01, Uffizi 02, and a different site having a different code. Would cost nothing. The information has never been asked by no one. So it's not necessary, it's not useful, it's not perceived as useful. Unfortunately, the problem is that you don't know how much personal costs are in your site. you know, that are more or less 711 people that more or less on average cost, but who knows what they really cost and how you can save, if you want to save, or how you can... You know what, I'm really furious with my Italian colleagues when they go around the world with this kind of missionary attitude. We teach you how to preserve, how to make restoration. They go to China and teach people how to do restoration. Be ashamed, be ashamed. Don't talk about Pompeii, don't talk about this kind of thing. It's a lack of responsibility about personal cost. I mean, know what really is, know what is there, what is what it is. When I say no reporting system, at that time, before the reform, you had to send, you know, it is almost, I would say, 700 years that human being invented financial statements. That you, basically, you have a summary of your invoice, bills, etc., and you keep it, and you show it, usually, to banks, to and public entities, or whoever, according to the rules, and you keep the bills just for special check if the tax office can, and you have to show that the numbers are right. They were not producing any kind of summary. They were simply sending the copy of the any single receipt. They had to make three copies, one for the national account in Rome, one for the regional account in Naples, and one for another body, the Corte dei Conti, and they were sending the zero copy. The poor four people were working a lot. That's crazy. I mean, when I was talking about four people doing just photocopies, they were working a lot for this. Yeah. So, and you had a small van that was just being, that was the accounting system, the van going around in the city and the Italy just giving zero copy. That is 1997, and it's still so in almost any superintendent. Lots of extra budget. We are such a smart people. We are able to invent new, we are so creative. So we have any special law for anyone, for everything, for Naples, for any kind of thing. So it, if you look at the numbers, the average yearly budget for extraordinary funding is higher than the normal. So what is extraordinary is more normal than the normal. It's crazy. It's really crazy. And I mean, that's, it's not just irrelevant. This is really, I mean, this kind of stupid mechanism is not just unuseful. It's making things even worse. So this is the data about the extraordinary funding. We are so smart, we fund money. You know, there was the Casa del Gladiatore collapse a couple of last week. Now they're talking, try to find extraordinary funding, which we find extraordinary funding in, we are so creative in that, when we are unable to find normally rules for managing. And these are the numbers. So you see that 8 billion lira every year compared to the 6 million, which is the normal funding. And this is the Casa di Castiamanti. No, it's the next. What is the purpose mechanism of this planning system that makes fragmentation even stronger? So you have to do all this kind of process. So let me. And you have this priorities. You have to open many small projects. I mean, running a project of 10 million lira or 100 million liras more or less takes the same from an administrative point of view. If you have to open hundreds of small projects, make your work crazy. And so you have this kind of figure. Sorry. Let me just try to see. This is the Casa di Castiamanti. This is something that in the States or in any other civilized country would be managed directly by with all of attention. You found a house that was under restoration in 79, because prior to 79 there was some earthquake. So you have the possibility to look at how people were working on housing, on restructuring housing at that time. So you have the fresco in the room that is at a different stage of finishing. And I learned when I was 47 years at that time that a fresco means in Italian a fresco that you have to paint is still wet. So there is an archaeologist that is trying to infer the organization of labor of the painting gang, the painting team of the time, having this kind of contextual data. Isn't it fascinating? If Harvard was able to buy it, how much could it put on it? And this is what we were spending, 100 or 200 million liras per year, 100,000 euro more or less. That's something that some of us spend in restructuring our own house, you know. It's really peanuts. And they had to take 12 years to be able to do this excavation that I would say a normal country would do in a couple of years or 3 years just to. So there is the kind of extraordinary intervention, this kind of increasing relevance of ad hoc projects, the lack of systematic procedures. And this kind of, you know, it's impossible to give an answer of how much has been spent by Pompeii, by someone who can be seen as responsible of Pompeii. There are lots of events, a lot of projects taking place, but no one is really in charge of the whole, is responsible for the whole. So, let's talk about the crisis of Pompeii, and that was the crisis 10 years ago. And of course, there are a lot of elements. I mean, mistakes done in the 50s, I mean, a lot of concrete that you can still see. To be honest, preserving Pompeii is terrible. It's a fortune. It cost a fortune. Corruption add a 10% to that fortune, which is a problem, but that's the area. There's a union pressure and so on, but also I would say there is an organizational explanation of the cause, of the reason for this decay. There is a notion of lack of accountability. It's impossible to know how much you spend, how you spend, and if you don't know how you spend and how much you spend, it's impossible to start any serious discourse about managing. Already Venetians were much better than Pompeii in tracing cost and defining budgets and so on. So, most of the time we have this kind of juxtaposition between management and professional. There's nothing similar here. That's not the problem. This is stupid rhetoric. The real problem is the bureaucrats and the rest of the world. It's the ministry and the lack of change. And interesting enough, if you look at the crisis, there's a very deliberate strategy by the superintendent himself to socially construct, I would say, the perception of the crisis. When I was talking about the articles in the press, all of them were talking about the decay of Pompeii, the collapse of the houses, the dogs, blah, blah, blah. I said, come on, what a shame. And we talked about that with the superintendent. It was himself that was making the problem visible to drive attention on Pompeii. And in the end, it seemed to be able, both getting the plan for Pompeii approved and getting even this institutional transformation to happen. So in a sense, the stopping the growth, the critical focus of restoration of a plan of Pompeii, it's a part of this social construction of the crisis. So I've been talking about the past. How was Pompeii before the reform? How is any other superintendenza in Italy apart from Pompeii, Venice, Florence, Rome, and there are another one. The rest of still there. Bologna is still this way. Now the innovation, the autonomous superintendenza. There was a board of directors rather than the superintendent. More than one person, that's really king, three persons. Unfortunately, with a peculiar way of defining the three. I mean, one is the superintendent, he's the responsible, the representative of the ministry, so that's quite acceptable. The city manager was to be an expert that can be hired temporarily on the private market with private kind of contract. And so the first is the superintendent. The second is chosen according to the performative principle. If you're good, you will be chosen. The third will be the oldest archaeologist of Pompeii. Could be even the most stupid or totally gone, gaga, whatever, but if as far as he's the oldest, he will be there for that. So it's a crazy logic of belonging coupled with this kind of performative principle. Was a city manager, is kind of empowered financial director. There were accounting autonomy. What? Unfortunately, when you do autonomy, you can do autonomy in a very different ways. And the apparatus from the ministry were forcing them to adopt a cash-based accounting system. This is a bit technical issue, but just to give an idea, all public sector all over the world has been debating in the last 20 years to move from a cash base to an accrual base. I'm not going to explain here what that's meant, but I'm sure that this will be the part of the collapse of Casa del Gladiatore, as I'm trying to show in another paper. But just to say, who was defining the rule? You're autonomous, but how you become autonomous is something that still the ministry is forcing you to do. So they were not free to choose the accounting form and the accounting system that would have been much more useful for them. They're accountable. There's a new notion of accountability. The first budget was a mess because the city managers has to knock on the door of every responsibility. What projects are going on? Because everyone was reporting to individual funding body. There was not a financial statement of Pompeii as such. So now a very revolutionary rule. There is a single income statement and financial statement on Pompeii. You can take money for every kind of reasons, for every kind of opportunities. That's good, but money should come in and go out from this kind of box. So every single penny spent in Pompeii should enter the income statement. That's a revolution. That's not happening in any other superintendents so far, still. And that's a notion of accountability. That's a partial accountability because, unfortunately, personal costs are not charged to Pompeii. Quite systematically, quite consistently, because they are run at the ministry level, the financial statement of Pompeii is one third of the real resources spent on Pompeii. Consider the situation of the single one block grant of the British Museum. This is the total check, spend as you want. Here we have a third of the check, that is all the cost but labor. And the labor costs are run and charged at the central level. Okay, so it's a partial accountability, and from an aesthetic point of view, I don't like it. I mean, it's not elegant, so to speak. It's just one third. Managerialism is affecting one third. There is some sort of incentive mechanism, which is you take the ticket. That was not before. The ticket was entering Pompeii, was going to Rome, and Rome was giving money around with according to different logics. Now, the great revolution, you take the ticket, you keep the ticket. So, the better you do, if you're starting doing some kind of beautiful experiment on Pompeii by night, and you charge 20 euros for Pompeii by night, you keep the money. So, this is what we call the Columbus Revolution, you know. It's so easy to think, and that was done. Finally, money that you earn, you can keep. So you have incentive to improve the service. So there is an incentive mechanism in this new situation. That was basically the logic. Now, still remember, I mean, this paper is the paper I have the best time perception of what, because it was so concentrated between October and March. And April, I was in Warwick, one of the most boring places in the UK. You can do nothing but writing. And it was, you know, when you have all these interviews, the document, you start thinking, reading, and start thinking, you start writing. And I love this kind of, this moment of the work is there, you know, where the creative. And I realized something. I said, come on, am I wrong? Or is it such a mess? It's not just that there is one third of financial statement that is under control. It's a bit more than that. If we also falling for those that were here this morning, if the problem in public sector is, I'm not saying outsourcing, but checking the organization of labor and deciding once again, do we need this? Do we need to do this inside or outside? Can we do better? Can we save money or doing it better? Doing buying or doing things, making or buying. Make or buying is one of the typical choice in management. Do we buy the cleaning of the bathroom or we clean directly the bathroom? So this kind of solution is totally against any logic of redefinition of the organization of labor. Suppose that you were able to find a different solution for wording, that rather than 450 words, will provide the same service with the youth cooperative or social cooperative of, let's say, 200 people. And suppose that you could do that without being killed by the mafia. And suppose the mafia do not need to kill anyone because no one will do it. There is no reason for me as a superintendent to organize the labor in a different way that makes the ministry save money because they're doing less work, less workers, and I will be penalized because I have bills of services that is charged to me. Is it clear? I mean, make or buy decision is affecting different entities with this stupid solution. If you make, you pay yourself. Sorry, the contrary. If you make with your workers, it's not paid by you. It's paid by the ministry. If you buy, you make the ministry save money and you spend more. So if you love Pompeii, if you care of Pompeii, you give it up to organization of labor and efficiency and say, okay, in any case, I prefer doing the restoration in the way which we can. So this is a really perverse mechanism. And I was making a telephone call to the city managers and said, hi, I was sorry, am I wrong? Am I right? I'm thinking, I'm writing. Is there a mistake on what I'm thinking? Blah, blah, blah. I was explaining this doubt. And I was talking to the superintendent. And I was saying, huh, that's serious. You should talk with the city manager. So I called the city manager and explained blah, 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 blah. And he said, huh, that's serious. We have to talk. So that was, in a sense, a mistake in the law, something that was not addressed. To be honest, I realized as I was writing, after 4 months, I was talking, interviewing people in Pompeii. But really, this is the logic of transformation that is. It is, of course, another unintended consequences. Basically, the left-wing, center-left government of Prodi has no intention to question with unions and with the organization of labor in public sector, and never happened even in the right-wing government later. So no one, they were not trying to do something so stupid. I mean, human being is limited in rationality. Even if you want stupidity, it's so difficult to really design this amount of stupidity. It's simply something happening. Nobody really thought of the consequences. And that is really the result. Unfortunately, you can make mistakes. You can change very easily the law. That did not happen. So still, Pompey do not know how much they spend on workers. Still, they don't have the freedom to move between make or buy. There are two very stupid things. To sum up what I understood in the museum, there are two stupid questions. Before the stupid question, I was writing them 1998. The major risk of Pompeii is that they will be unable to spend the money that they get. Because they will get more the money from the ticket, but they are unable to reorganize labor. They will be unable to spend the money that they have. And it was even published in English, so you can check. In English was translated in 2001. It was there. And in 2006, indeed, the Ministry Buttiglione from the right-wing government was stealing, in metaphorical sense, but with a legal instrument, he made a special law, 30 million euros from Pompeii that were still waiting to be used. And in 2008, another 40 million euros were still stolen by another special administration. So that is why, in the end, wall collapsed. The gladiator house collapsed. That was what I was saying to the journalist yesterday. This is the end of a bloody story. It's not walls itself. Of course, walls have the natural tendency. That is entropy. I mean, that's normal. The problem is how you resist, how you manage it. And this is an organizational issue. There is no question of getting money. They were unable to spend money. They are lacking organizational solution. So, and as I was saying, the very stupid question that can sum up a lot of discussion, which is one stupid question is, can you clean or buy a server for cleaning the bathroom? This is a strategic choice. Whether you are free to make a decision 107 times a year, and today, this morning, I'm changing, and I'm free to change. Or you have to prepare, you know, you have to go through the ministry or all these kind of things. Cleaning the bath is just a standard job. Consider if you think in terms of organizing your research or an exhibition. But this is one organizational issue. The other is whether you are able to keep additional money if you're able to generate. These are two very stupid things that sum up the issue, the real issue of autonomy. So when you're going to make interviews, remember these two stupid, I would love to see, to have an answer to these two stupid questions in all categories of your research. Because people tend to talk of autonomies as ideology, as abstract terms. Are you able to, take the clear, elegant, consistent extreme of the British Museum one block rent, take the extreme, clear, consistent choice of direct managing, and the rest is a continuum of mess. It's a new category, a continuum of mess at different ways in between. Where you can, the two questions will, is always, and I'm fascinating how such two stupid questions can always address, at least so far, my research, the point of change, the difficulties of change in management. So what about the implications? This kind of contradiction between management and curatorial aspect. There is, in our country, I guess, the third relevant actor, which is bureaucracy, and how bureaucracy are not coping with either the need of professionals nor managerial people. What I like in this research and I learn is how important it is to qualify activities. What do you really do? I don't care about the mission statement of the museum, either because what we talked this morning, whatever the ministry say, I don't trust him, particularly this ministry, but I guess the last six ministries from Prodi now on, with the three different colors and six different governments, all more or less the same in terms of not understanding the problems and the solution. You have to understand what is done in Pompeii, what are the problems, and in this sense, it's not a question of mission, it's a question of understanding what you are managing, what you are doing. And organizations, human resources, and financial resources are the crucial issue in this process of change. And unless you are able to link all this kind of debate on transformation, autonomy, professionalism, to the way in which budgets are done, the way in which money are spent, or the way in which people are organized or not organized. I mean, unless you're able to link that to this aspect, we are really selling what in Italy we say fried air, you know, it's aria fritta. If you are unable to link to funding the ways, numbers, patterns, and numbers of people, it's really a very, it's terrible. No one would say, I don't like autonomy. It's like a mission statement. There is some sort of value implication. Of course, decentralization is a must. Of course, autonomy is good. But then people talking once again ideologically more than say, okay, what is the business model? Who makes the decision where, how funds come? This is something that, you know, I think that the notion of accountability is crucial. Most of the time, we'll talk tomorrow about local museums. Most of the time, accounts of the museums are not known, not just by external research, which is an issue, but even inside, there's simply not certain information. And I guess this is similar to some extent here as well. So the notion of accountability is a crucial notion and is a prerequisite to do any serious debate on responsibility, on economic, on managerial aspects. You know, I hate the notion of social accounting because people try to talk of social accounting before having solved the problem with accounting. So please give me first your financial statement, then you can talk about social responsibility. But first give me, please upload on your website, as the British Museum do, your financial statement, and then you can start wasting our time on social responsibility. And this is really, this is not a conflict, however, between museum people, between professionals and management scholar. In a sense, I think it's a sort of three-dimensional tension between management knowledge, between professional knowledge, and between bureaucracy, and the way in which bureaucracy can be transformed through management according to some sort of managerial discourse in the way in which you do professional tasks. So, and most important, the missing chapter of the debate in heritage in Italy, and I think that's one of the, to be honest, I'm one of the few that's talking about organization of labor and this issue. It's so crucial. It's not one additional thing. I mean, if you don't address the issue of organization of labor, you're not addressing the issue of managing. And for just to conclude, there was if you are an archaeologist, managing people is one of the most boring things in your life. There was a book by a journalist in favor, in defense of curators, and say, we force superintendenti to deal with people. So come on, if you don't deal with people, someone else will deal with people. So at the end, if you give it up, don't be surprised if you have 711 people with 16 archaeologists and historians. So this is a very sad story so far, and I'm not giving you the update version because it's much sadder than this, and this is the incoming paper. But this is an idea of how difficult it is to transform our central administration. State museums are so impossible to change. It's not a surprise that you have a similar tension to foundation, to process of privatization in the public sector. It's impossible to change the central administration. It's so, we were joking this morning, historians in 100 to 100 years, when they will discover our papers, say, those guys were crazy, that public entities that were setting up private law organizations that were, why didn't they simplify the state, the public sector? This is one of the general debate that is linked to archaeology, museology, and so on. I mean, the transformation of public sector all over the world in parallel to this kind of professional debate. So, tomorrow we are going to talk about local authority museum and the problems of transformation of local authority museums. So you have the picture of the difficulties of transformation of public sector in Italy. Then, in the afternoon, I will try to address this similar kind of issues to two different international contexts. One is Machu Picchu, one is China. Just to see, it's not an issue that is just the poor old country, Italy. It's not our own problem. Of course, I guess we're really doing worse than many of. I'm talking about worst practice, as I mentioned this morning. Congratulations to you on your ability to survive. It was too much. This is the next paper, but just to put in a short, just a few numbers. This amount of visitors, the ticket is very low, I have to say, it's 10 euros. I mean, I think if you pay $45 in Machu Picchu, you could realistically ask for 40 or 50,000 euros for a visit in Pompeii. If people do not come, some do not come, it's good because you have too many visitors. Now it's almost 2 million. So, but it's just 10 euros. So 10 euros means more or less 20-25 million euros per year. In 10 years, 20-25 million per year should mean 250 million euros. That were more or less what the plan for Pompeii was asking 10 years ago. So what is the achievement, the result in terms of the plan of Pompeii? In a sense, you were asking for 500 billion lira, 250 billion million euros. You got it. What have you done? They spent almost 60, 70 million euros on that. And the other was just general things, basically I mean, it's not just Pompeii, there is additional places. In the meanwhile, they make a new discovery of Poggio Marino, so they found discovery, very important ships under the sea, so they spent enormous amount of money on that, and it was unplanned, it was not a spaceship. So, and that I can give you an answer in very detail on how expenditure were, where money was spent. It was not enough. It was not just Pompeii itself, but all the other sites. And on Pompeii restoration, they were just spending one fourth, one fifth of what they were planning in the plan for Pompeii. So they are late. They lose other 70 million euros. That was another fourth of the plan of Pompeii. So, that's it, more or less. So on the total, they spent one fourth on the restoration, one fourth has been stolen by various ministries, and the other was spent on other things, basically. That's more or less the figures. And but what's from a substantive point of view, from a procedural point of view, I think what is really astonishing that no one was forced or thought that was nice to produce a report of 10 years of this reform. The reform is now collapsing totally, and I have no time now. I mean, that's the new paper that was the intervention of the Protezione Civile. I don't know if you are familiar with Bertolaso and the other gang of these people that are specialists in earthquake managing, basically, that were taking care of the extraordinary situation of Pompeii, and that was the last 2 years till the collapse of the Casa dei Gladiatori. But what is interesting, even the superintendente himself, when he retired, did not perceive the need to give a report of my last 10 years. And I was saying, come on, Guzzo, I like him, I love him, and he's a nice person. So, but it's so, you know, the lack of understanding of the need to give account, to report. Unless to save your body, I mean, to save your, because they will criticize you. They will tell that is his fault, and no one really was in the position of saying we should make a point. We made an experiment. What is the experiment all about? It's gone. Buttiglione was stealing 30 million. The other was stealing another 40 million. That was the right wing, two different governments of the right wing. In between there was a left wing government that was simply abolishing the position of the city manager without making a point of it. It didn't work. We need something else. Write a paper, a white paper, call a brilliant professor somewhere else, not just in Bologna, all over the world, a consultant, whatever, an external independent researcher, and make an evaluation, international, whatever. Nothing similar. Simply disappear. The autonomous superintendenza is not more there. They put together Naples and, sorry, part of the pony, where it's gone, put together Naples and Pompeii, and the last year of the superintendenza was the superintendenza of Naples and Pompeii. And that means that you get enormous amount of cost by Naples that you are funding with the money from the Pompeii. So I'm not able to give you the exact figure, but part of this 250 was spent on Naples out of any bargain plan. And in the last two, you know, the last two superintendenti after Guzzo retired in 2008 was at the very end of their career, this is the last 11 months. How can you send someone in such a complicated issue, in such a complicated side? It takes you 2 years to understand where you are, the people, who you can trust or not. And that's really, you know, the kind of position that are used for kind of political compensation. You are a good friend, that's a very prestigious side for the last 12 months and send you there.
I may be asking a question that you'll answer tomorrow, but when you had accountability up, you also had the phrase emancipation from the political, which I take to mean from bureaucracy and from corruption. On the other hand, if you know the only solution is privatization, and again, you know, we're all positioned, and I happen to be from the U.S., where privatization has really gone awry, yeah, and has its own corruptions in terms of values, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm wondering, you know, sort of where do we go? And I'm also wondering is if there's some other sort of political, yeah, like political with the civil that, society to change exactly culture.
So let's try to be positive in the end, so you can sleep and relax. I don't think privatization is an issue. I think that privatization, strictly speaking, is not possible. It's not possible. It's not necessary. It's not interesting for anyone, at least in this part of the world. I think there is another issue that is taking place, which is de-statization, which is transforming, weakening the kind of constraint that we have. You know, I'm a public university. I have a close number of students, 30 students. That increase the quality of the service we provide. That is a public competition by law. If the Bocconi University, which is a private university, do it, there's no problem. They can do and select in a what arbitrarily way they want. You know, there are two different set of rules. Being public in Italy, but I guess here as well, does not mean simply one set of rules. You buy the old ticket, you have the public employees, that civil servant with this kind of rules. You have the visitor, the access that have public rules and public, and so on and so forth. So you have thousands of laws and norms that you buy. This is the problem. I'm not thinking that you have to privatize. When you explain to American students privatization in Europe, which is not selling the assets to private, but it's simply what we were talking this afternoon, publicly run, publicly owned and privately run, that is simply the solution. It's trying to find, I mean, it is the municipality of Milan that was the owner of the private law foundation of civil local authority museum that was supposed to be run. Actually, the museum in Venice has been transformed into the private law entity that is run by a private body, which is owned by the municipality of Venice. The Egyptian Museum, that was another superintendenza in Turin, is a private foundation, which is run privately with some kind of lobbying people that, you know, is not professionally out of criticism, but is owned by the ministry, the local authority, to foundations, and so on. So this is the real issue, how you get rid of the, and it's enormous amount of stupid red tape that we have to do with day to day, with constraints that have no reasons, either for the back office, for the users, for no one, if not the bureaucracy itself. And I'm really radical on that. I want to be privatized. I would be happy when the University of Bologna, after 900 years, will become private, not to be a private business as the Bocconi. We don't want, no, the question is how you define roles and ways in which you can, I mean, between these two extremes, I mean, I'm looking for the third view between the private and the state run. With, I mean, I think we should still keep the notion of public service, but you can do private public service with the forms that are closer to private kind of professional relationships, workers' contract, and so on. And we try to do, maybe tomorrow I'm trying also to talk a bit more about the transformation in Milan. Perhaps it could be interesting because it's a good example. So let me, I will take note on that.